if I say dancing with nature, I'm dancing, the plants are leading the way, and I'm just their dancing partner. There's a curiosity because, I mean, you could probably define curiosity better, but it's not really knowing, not having it set in your mind that this is what you're going to do, but being open to it changing, and then you're just dancing according to their rhythm.
This is Choose to be Curious, a show all about curiosity. We talk about research and theory, but mostly it's conversations about how curiosity shows up in work and life. I'm your host, Lynn Borton. Welcome. Come, choose to be curious with us. Some years ago, I interviewed neuroscientist Jacqueline Gottlieb about the science around paying attention. Among other things, she was measuring eye movements as a proxy for interest. She was trying to understand how we humans decide to pay attention or not to things around us. We talked a lot about sampling, trying to sort out what's of interest or value to us as an expression of curiosity, and the rewards we seem to know will come of our forays, even if we don't know exactly what those rewards will be. Since then, Jackie has continued to examine how we prioritize sources of information. She's come to view priority as a cognitive state that, quote, implements information gathering policies. Policies we draw on when information serves both instrumental and non-instrumental motives, suggesting, she says, that curiosity and instrumental information demand are more closely related than is traditionally assumed. Meaning, maybe we need to appreciate how not just curious we actually are when we're curious. Our curiosities have important motivators, values rooted within each of us, whether we know or understand it or not. Links to all of this on my website, and a note to self to get another conversation with Jackie. I've been thinking about foraging. Going from place to place, looking for things one can eat, is a lot like the sampling and prioritizing of information gathering that Jacqueline Gottlieb has been studying, just applied to things that many of us likely dismiss as weeds. It was my own informational foraging, my own little search in proverbial unfamiliar places, that brought me to Tama Matsuaka Wong, financial lawyer turned professional forager. Tama got curious about the weeds around her when she moved to a fixer-upper house in northern New Jersey. She started to see them and the whole ecosystem around her differently and really began to appreciate all that they have to offer. That led to sourcing top-tier restaurants in Manhattan that now count on her to deliver all manner of foraged goods from her meadows, and to writing a cookbook, Foraged Flavor, which was nominated for a James Beard Award, and co-writing Scraps, Wilt, and Weeds, which won the IACP Food Matters Award. Now, she's got a new book out, Into the Weeds, How to Garden Like a Forager, that she hopes empowers budding and experienced gardeners alike to embrace a gentler, less rigid, and more sustainable approach to tending the land. I saw that gentler and less rigid line, and I knew I was on to someone with a real curiosity about how to be in the world. I'm delighted to have Tama Matsuaka Wong with me to get into the weeds today. Welcome, Tama.
Hi, thanks for having me. That was a great intro.
Well, I'm very excited to finally be able to have this conversation with you. And congratulations on a beautiful book. I took it with me when I went to visit my parents last weekend, and they both had the same reaction as I did, which was like, oh, so congratulations.
Wow, that's good.
It's a good indicator, right?
Yeah, that's great.
So when did you first think of yourself as curious, maybe in general or about plants in particular?
I have to say that I go back to my parents. And my mother is from Hawaii, but she met my dad in New Jersey. My dad is Japanese, but he's a scientist. So in a weird way, they're both very curious. And my mother was sort of a real plants woman, I would say. And so I wasn't that curious about it because she knew everything. So I could just go to her. I didn't really have to investigate too much. Like, it would be like, what's this and what's that? And then she would make my brother and myself go out and, you know, forage for her when she wanted things. And she loved gardening and she loved cooking. So I think it just all went together. And my father, he was a scientist at Bell Labs. So he looked at the basic matter, like what are the principles of matter? But he had this sort of Japanese romanticism about the seasons and the plants there, which is in his culture. And so I think putting those, all that together ended up instilling me in certain things that now I look back and I see why I went the way I ended up going.
Oh, interesting. You know, you wrote somewhere that it's all about developing your own skill of observation. And it sounds like you've learned a couple of different ways of observing and being, and you've woven them together in a kind of nice way.
Thing about the way things have happened, it's been very, for me, it's been very organic. Like, I definitely did not plan to leave my perfectly good job. And I still have people that are from my old, you know, circle of people that when I say I'm a forager, they kind of look at me like, what is that? You know, but it's kind of fine. I think everybody has their journey. And I'm certainly very happy in the journey that I've taken.
Oh, that's very cool. I think it's maybe in the close of your latest book, you have a little story about bringing a bag of unknowns to a chef. And you said that surprises bring out his inner curiosity. Like, he's looking at this bag of stuff, who knows what it is, right?
And yes.
And I thought the whole book and this whole conversation, I thought that's sort of it right there, is that this idea of the surprises of what's around me, what didn't I know was here, and what that triggers. Is there a story with the chef? And do you remember that incident? Is there a story with that?
Well, yeah, so the answer is yes. And it's not even, it's just like, it happens all the time, like every year, all the time. I mean, I think one of the interesting things about what I'm doing now is, and I think has still a lot to do with curiosity and that people might think about, is that we're all stuck in our own little tribes. So you're hanging around with the same people. They all have the same acronyms that they think everybody else knows what they mean, but they don't.
Yep.
And then you start getting very fixed and you might think you're curious, but it's a very narrow way. So right now, the way I live, like, I know people who are like really disconnected. So I have chefs coming from all kinds of backgrounds. I have bartenders. I have farmers. I have EMT workers. I have plants people. It's just like people from all over that you would never think, they would never normally come across each other. But sometimes when you put them together, amazing things happen.
Yeah.
In a way, all I'm doing is kind of connecting these dots. And if you look at it that way, it's infinitely curious. And everybody is, you know, curious, but I think you just get stuck in your little niche and that kind of prevents you from being curious because you're not really open to conversations outside of the ones you're having with the same people over and over.
That's really interesting. And it resonates with what you write about rewilding and reconnecting. And I think you're writing in that context about reconnecting with the world. But all those different people, all those different tribes are part of the world, right? They're part of our ecosystem.
Yeah, and I think that's the way you come up with solutions too. You know, we have a lot of challenges and we need everybody to use their powers of curiosity and innovation and work to get there. I can tell you this, a chef story, an example. Like, this is very, very typical.
Yeah.
So I was working with a pastry chef and every year, like now I'm already like really maxed out. So people want the stuff they want, but they're also always curious. and I'd have to say that the defining thing about the chefs I work with is not like how high end or low end or what, it's about their ingredient focused. Because some people, you know, they just don't have the bandwidth or the way their menu is or the place they're working. There's no room to do that kind of stuff. But some places, that's what they're about.
Right.
They're just about, I mean, it does happen that Michelin star chefs, if you look at what's a Michelin star, it's how good is the quality of the ingredients. So if you're in that realm, for sure, you have to think about your ingredients. But it can get really boring doing service year, week after week after night, and you're just having the same things. And after 20 years, how many times have you seen a strawberry and blah? So especially now where people are tired of root vegetables, I mean, we all are here at least on the East Coast. So I had this one client, and most of my clients I have for like forever, for decades, like you did never. So I think he was from Croatia or Serbia, but he had actually spent some time in the war. They actually lived off the land. And so I was bugging me like, what's out now? And it's like, this was like in the middle of winter or something. And I was like, okay, well, there's like bark, right? Like, you know? And he's like, his eyes light up. He's like, bark, you know, like he's worked with bark before when during the war or something. So I was like, sure, you know. And so then, I mean, I always research. I mean, as part of your curiosity, you also need to understand, has this been recognized as being edible and documented that humans have eaten them and not, you know, fallen over or had a seizure or something? And I look at it from an environmental perspective. So is there a way that you can harvest this and it's not affecting a plant that is, you know, you're affecting the ecology of that part of the land? Right. And so I settled on shagbark hickory bark. It's a hickory. It grows like all over the floodplains. It's in my backyard. And it's really shag bark. Like the bark peels off. It shags off like a shaggy old man, right? Like if you imagine an ent in the Lord of the Rings, I think they would be like a shag bark hickory bark. That's what I imagine. So
that's a great image.
And then because it's shagging off, you can peel it off without hurting the tree, because normally if you take the bark off, it's hurting the tree. So I bring in a bunch of this bark. And I mean, I have to tell you, if you have any, you should go look, because it just, it looks and smells like a house shingle, you know, it's totally uninteresting. But I read that Native Americans had used this when they boiled it or something. It made a syrup that was really good for your health. It's a tonic. And it also tasted kind of like hickory-like or something. And so I thought, oh, well, maybe I can placate this guy for now until spring really comes. So I bring this bark in, and I have to say, people used to things coming in little packages, and we just put it in a backpack, and this big bark was sticking out of the backpack as we walked down 23rd Street in Manhattan, and people are staring at us like, what, you know, what is that? And when we walk into the pastry part of the kitchen, there, you know, it gets a lot of attention. So that's kind of fun anyway.
Yes.
We bring this bark, and he's just so excited. And then I don't know. I don't even know. I just leave them to do their curiosity thing. I don't know how. Maybe it wasn't long. Like a week later, they're like, oh my God, shagbark hickory bark ice cream. It's like flying off the menu. We've got on the menu more, more, more. And I have to say, next time I was there, I ate some of this. And I thought, wow, it really tastes like not at all like I would think it would taste. It tastes like caramelized, nutty, like this ice cream. But I have to really admit here that in my mind, and maybe this is part of curiosity, I was a little skeptical because, you know, I do have a legal background. So I'm kind of like, well, maybe put some like hickory syrup juice or something in there to make it, you know, because I mean, seriously, it just was like a house jingle. So then I was actually at the time writing this column or like foraging thing for Food 52. And I said, oh, you know, if you make the recipe, I'll put it into this column. So that really got them excited. So they sent me this recipe. I had to edit it because it was like for 200 people or something. Then I actually had to test it in a home kitchen. If your listeners go to Food 52 and log in shagbark hickory bark ice cream, they'll get it. And is interesting is the transformation from something that's like a house shingle. And when you put it in the oven, I think it's like 230 degrees for 8 minutes, immediately you smell this amazing nutty smoke, you know, coming out. And actually that's hickory smoke, right? So you could grill, you could do a whole bunch of other things with it. And then when you infuse that, and if you have some nuts, keep them frozen and you can just smash them. You don't have to peel the nuts because it's too much trouble. But you could get even more nuttiness, and you throw it into milk, put a little sugar, and then you heat it up and then you let it infuse. And when you're doing that, then you get the caramelization. So you get this nutty, and then you see the transformation. It's amazing.
You're listening to Choose to be Curious. I'm your host, Lynn Borton, and I'm joined today by Tama Matsuoka Wong, professional forager. That's such a great story. And I love it that it's sort of layers of curiosity, right? He had it like, can you find me a something? And you're like, okay, what might that be?
Sometimes they don't even have, most of the times, they don't really have a can you find me something. I mean, they might. I have one guy, he was one of the founders of NOMA, which is really into this. And he'd be like, leaves, I need leaves. You know, so he might have a category. But other than that, a lot of times it's just like, what is out there? You know, they're stuck in some basement kitchen and they're like, what is out there? What is in nature? What's happening? You know, they want to feel it through the plants.
Right.
So it's more like that.
I love that because then you sort of go out like, well, what is out there? You don't have any idea what they're going to do with it, right? In fact, you might be skeptical about what they can do with it. But yeah. You have some confidence in their exploration and curiosity once you bring this back to them. It's kind of a virtuous cycle. I really like that.
Yeah. And a lot of it is about community. And so then a lot of these other people, you know, the other people I work with on the other side might be like organic farmers or conservation people or anyone. And they're just like, there's this plant. I hate it. Right? Like, I hate it. Can you take it away? Right. And I'll go and I'll be like, oh my God, this is a gourmet treat in Asia or Central America or whatever. And you know, then they're calling me like, Matsuoka, you're falling down the job. Come back and get more, right? But sometimes I'll feed back to them, you know, blah, blah, blah is using it this way. You could do it. So it's a great kind of cycle. I wouldn't say it's a community in that kind of let's all use the same acronyms community, but it is a community of sorts.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of the things that attracted me to your work was your interest in and your attention to stewardship, which is also a communal, if not a kind of community. We don't necessarily all do it together in a way, but we have a communal interest mm-hmm. in the stewardship of the planet. And you're tapping a lot of different sides of that conversation and reimagining how we might intersect. And I guess it's the final chapter of your book, right? The future is unknown. And attention to that sort of uncertainty of what's ahead of us and bringing everybody to the proverbial table.
Well, I have to say when I started doing this with chefs more than a decade ago, I think initially people might have thought it was kind of flaky, but I think more and more people, well, definitely people are interested in being outdoors and what is outdoors.
Right.
And I think that with things changing, everyone knows things are changing. I mean, I see it because I'm in the field all the time, but I think everybody is aware that change is here and that we cannot control that change and that we are now living in this age, I call it gardening in the Anthropocene, but we are living in an age that we have impacted every part of the planet. Man, you know, this is the age which man has disturbed everything. And so how do we live in that kind of way? And I think how to adapt to change and how to make more resilience, both from the Earth's point of view and us as humans connected to the Earth. That's my passion and it's part of the mission of my company. And it's just, intrinsically tied together.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I wanted to talk to you about savoring.
Okay.
Because you talk so beautifully about this in your book, specifically about wandering and being in a place and savoring the place, which I think of as a curiosity practice of sort of really being fully present in a place. And I just wanted to invite you to reflect on that because I thought this was just a lovely set of observations on your part.
I love the kind of day that's not structured. And I'm going to go out and savor the day. And a lot of people want to come out and trail me. What is it really like? Because I'm a practitioner. I'm not just writing about a thing. I'm not doing classes all the time. My place is not an open public place for people to come and visit because it's my happy place, right? And so people ask me to trail me. And in one way, that's why I wrote the book. So if you want to see how I savor things, you can read that, but you're not going to be able to trail me.
So good for you. Boundaries. Good for you.
And then my book editor, she was trying to explain this book to some other people. And she said, it's kind of the let it be way of gardening. So there's things that are there. And then it's like, what is the day bringing? Right. And then I might set out to do this one thing, but I end up getting stuck on observing some amazing thing that I didn't even know. But because I'm not rushing through, either trying to rush through and name everything or rush through and look at the signs. I'm just kind of experiencing. And then from a foraging perspective, you know, you might set out and be like, okay, today I'm going to get this, but turns out it's not ready, but oh, wait, there's this other thing and I never noticed that before. And so I call it dancing with nature. If I say dancing with nature, I'm dancing, the plants are leading the way and I'm just their dancing partner. There's a curiosity because, I mean, you could probably define curiosity better, but it's not really knowing, not having it set in your mind that this is what you're going to do, but being open to it changing, and then you're just dancing according to their rhythm.
I love that. And that's a lovely place to pause and invite you to do my big jar of wannabe analogies.
Oh,
you okay. Game?
Yes.
Okay. All right. So my literal big jar. I've got slips of paper in here.
Okay,
so I have three slips, one for you, one for me, one for the audience. And okay, yours is bubble bath. How is curiosity like a bubble bath? Mine is andiron.
Oh my gosh, I'm glad I didn't get yours. I'd have to even like look up.
And I have one for the audience. So you want to go first or you want me to go?
You go first.
Okay, andiron. Okay, so an andiron is a thing that you put into a fireplace that holds the logs into place. So I'm going to say that curiosity is the thing that holds the fire of your passions, and it kind of allows the air to get into it and holds the fuel. That's how curiosity is like an andiron.
Wow.
How?
That is good. That is really good.
It's pretty good on this spot. So how is curiosity like a bubble bath?
Okay, bubble bath is easy, right? Because no single bubble is the same. It really isn't.
Nice.
I mean, I think of a bubble bath as like snowflakes. And okay, I am going to say something about plants in here because you're not going to get me away from the plant part.
Oh, good.
So I am totally obsessed right now about this idea of singularity, right? Every bubble in a bubble bath is singular. And curiosity is like learning and experiencing all that amazing diversity. And what I've learned, because I just finished as part of my curiosity, I just finished this winter doing a course on medicinal plants at eCornell, which is excellent, is that even though a plant is how singular the plants that you will find on, like, let's say your little patch are, even from another same species. So I'm just going to take this, and this is what has to do with the bubble bath, okay? So for example, if you take a very common invasive weed, Artemisia vulgaris, which they're studying a lot now from a medicinal point of view. And now, so that's good because they've studied the organic chemistry of each, and they found that this is an invasive plant. So it's in Brazil, and it's in New Zealand, and it's in the US. And the fascinating thing is that even though it's the same species and the morphology, like the way it looks, all the things that make it, that's are the same. Mm-hmm. The organic chemistry can be completely different.
Oh my gosh.
I know. This is so exciting. I mean, plants have what they call primary metabolites and secondary metabolites. So the primary metabolites are just what the plant needs to survive. And it's not really very much chlorophyll, cellulose, and so et cetera. But all those things that are the secondary metabolites, which are like the aroma of mint or, you know, some amazing smell of nettle or something, those are what the plant forms in reaction to environmental factors.
Oh, like interesting.
And see, this is what I'm positing to everybody. Maybe someone will know. I'm positing that, well, if plants are producing different types of organic secondary metabolites in response to their environment. So maybe the reason why a plant in blah has Artemisia vulgaris has a camphor and it has no camphor in another place, right, at all, it has something else, is because the environment is different or the bugs are different or whatever.
Yeah.
So they're producing different chemicals. I mean, it's amazing. So the bubbles, right? They're all coming in at different times and they're all going to be different depending how long you blow, where you are. Are you in the bathtub or are you like outside? So I think curiosity is like that. It's like never ending, and it you have questions and it just makes more questions, but it's fascinating.
Oh my gosh. Yes. I'm going to have to talk to several different people about that. We'll see what we can, find. We'll see what we can find.
I'm positing. I'd like some answers. I'm very curious.
I love it. I love it. Ah, wow. Okay. And audience, yours is attic. How is curiosity like an attic? Let us know.
That's a good one.
Social
that's
media, good. Hashtag analogy. Yeah. Well, Tama, what a great conversation. Thank you so much for this.
Oh, thanks. It's really been fun. And you just made me more curious than ever.
You've been listening to Choose to be Curious. I'm your host, Lynn Borton. Thanks for joining us today. You can find all my shows on my website at choosetobecurious.com. I hope you'll follow me here, there, and on social media, where you can share your attic analogy, hashtag analogy. Many thanks to my guest, Tama Matsuoka Wong. Links to her website and for her book, Into the Weeds, on my website, along with my conversation with Jacqueline Gottlieb. It's a good one. Thanks, too, to Lisa Hill for getting me early access to the beautiful book. Our theme music is by Sean Ballack, and this is Lakeside Path by Duck Lake via Blue Dot Sessions. Tama and I share a passion for the underappreciated Pine Barrens of southern New Jersey, and I wanted to share a snippet of our side conversation about that before I let you go.
First, I'd say that most people who kind of want to come out and, you know, go foraging, they are like, okay, you know, come up to this and I want to see the wild. I want to see the wild. And then I'm like, oh, just like look in the back of the parking lot. And so, you know, there's all this great wild stuff. And a lot of the weeds actually like to grow where people are. When people aren't satisfied that and they really want magic, okay, then I take them to the Pine Barrens. So it's, I mean, it's one of the largest preserved lands on the East Coast, east of the Mississippi, I think, aside from the Everglades now. But it's very, very unique. And it was called barren. And it wasn't until they discovered blueberries and cranberries, which actually are indigenous and that was first discovered, that they realized that how much amazing things were there.
I hope you'll join us again next time. Until then, choose to be curious.
So when I talk about the singular, how plants are singular, it just means if you find people just want to go out and plant something. Okay, I want to change and I want to plant things. I don't want to see what's there first. But what could be there might be a singular plant whose organic chemistry is unlike any other plant because of its terroir or whatever. It's very singular and special. So like, don't wreck things. You might have something and you think it's a weed because you didn't plant it, but it might be better than anything you can plant.